Part 1. Brainstorm. From Broken to Blessed on the Bipolar Spectrum. Chapter 1. The Brain. As vast as the cosmos and equally uncharted. I wake up at 5 a.m., sandwiched between my daughter and my husband. It's the year 2007, and I'm 46 years old. There is a new moon in the pre-dawn winter sky. I slip out of bed without waking them and draw my morning tub, filling it with lavender, rose, and eucalyptus oils. 30 minutes of jet therapy later, I ascend to my tower, an 8-foot square room up a staircase from our bedroom that I've dedicated to yoga, prayer, and meditation. I stretch each morning to Hebrew chants, moving my body slowly and rhythmically to the music, feeling each muscle ease into the morning. 2 hours later, I'll wake the twins, Maya and Sam, with gentle kisses. Get up for school, guys. Time to get dressed and eat breakfast. Gotta catch the bus. Dress warm. It's winter cold out there. They're now 4 years past infancy, and I still love the smell of their heads, the scent of innocence and dreams. I inhale as I hug them, my vitamins M and S. I pick out clothes for work. This afternoon, I'll be flying to Chicago for a meeting, and I want to look sharp. It's a conservative setting, so I'll dress respectably but with flair. Gray skirt and matching jacket from Eileen Fisher, dark purple silk sweater, Klimt scarf, boots, jade earrings, and a necklace from the Red Sea. I turn my focus to the kids. Breakfast, boots, coats, hats, gloves, and hugs later, and they're off to kindergarten. I kiss Joe goodbye before he drives to his new job with an entrepreneurial.com in New Hampshire. Since my flight is much later, I head up the hill with my beloved old yellow lab, Starhawk, to meet a friend for a walk. Leia and I have crampons on our shoes and carry ski poles. It's icy. We walk down to the brook and then alongside it through the woods, 3 miles. It's exceptionally beautiful in February, as every day is changing temperature, humidity, and wind combine to create new ice sculptures. Water flows under ice and around a hard rock ledge, giving a womb-like soundtrack to this walk. After our walk, I'll put on work clothes, pack my computer, palm, cell phone, and Bluetooth, and head to the airport. But I'll stop by Swift River Elementary School to hug Sam and Maya. They'll wrap themselves around me and smother me with kisses, still too young to hide their affection from peers. We love you, Mom. We can't stop hugging you. An unremarkable scene from a midlife working mom who lives in rural Massachusetts and is blessed with a flexible schedule, a supportive husband, healthy twins, and a strong sense of gratitude for all that life gives her. It sounds like an enviable, maybe even outrageously luxurious, life. Unless you know what was happening in the same life less than 6 months prior. It sounds melodramatic, but here's the truth. Death was at my door hour by hour. I was in the throes of an uncontrollable depression, unable to get out of bed, dreaming about suicide as a welcome relief. Each hour of my life, if you can even call it that, was a painful reminder that another hour of excruciating existence would come, and then another, and then another. I had been suffering for a long time with an undiagnosed disease of the brain. It had sapped my intellect, energy, and spirit. I didn't know what was going on. My brain had stopped working. I couldn't add simple numbers, do the dishes, dress my kids, or make them lunch. I was unable to respond to emails, return phone calls, or write a coherent sentence. My characteristic humor was gone. Smiling was painful for the muscles in my face. My libido was gone. I stopped washing my hair because it took too much energy to remember how to do it. My fingers were bloody because I was addicted to ripping my cuticles. The cruel voice inside my head chanted at me relentlessly. Your family would be better off if you were dead. I could think only of impending catastrophes. We'd get in a car accident driving down our icy hill. Joe would lose his job. I'd never make love, play sports, or enjoy friends again. The world was being poisoned by toxic chemicals, and global warming was going to kill us all anyway. My kids, who were 4 years old at that time, had no idea what was going on with Mom, except that she was no fun anymore. She wouldn't play any games with them, didn't even have the energy to take them outside, and mostly wanted to sleep. My choices seemed to be a psych ward, electroconvulsive therapy, or suicide. My husband and family were trying to decide if they should check me into a locked psych ward at the hospital in Holyoke or try shock therapy. Somewhere in the recesses of my mind, I knew I couldn't leave my four-year-olds with the legacy of a mother who had died by suicide. Although I was barely alive and wanted to stop the pain forever, I couldn't choose death over my children. How had I come to this state with a loving husband, the twins of my dreams, circles of friends, and fulfilling work? A life of enviable abundance and privilege. I wasn't suffering from everyday depression. It wasn't situational. I wasn't sad. I hadn't experienced a painful loss of a loved one. I didn't have post-traumatic stress disorder from a near-death accident. I wasn't a victim of incest, rape, or abuse. I have an anomaly in my DNA, an accident of genetics I now know is bipolar 2, or soft bipolar. 90% of the time, this disease is misdiagnosed as standard depression. It presents with the classic symptoms: exhaustion, negativity, hopelessness, loss of joy in life. But this diagnosis is the kiss of death for a bipolar brain like mine, and for those of millions of people in this country alone who suffer from bipolar 2. Here's why. The standard meds for depression, SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, like Prozac, Lexapro, Paxil, and Zoloft, are poison to the bipolar brain. They actually make us sicker, more anxious, more psychotic, and more willing to act on suicidal thoughts. This was true for me. The depressions I'd suffered from on and off for 25 years without medication had become dangerously worse when I was on Lexapro and Prozac. What makes bipolar 2 hard to diagnose is that people with it don't show the classic signs of mania associated with bipolar 1, also known as manic depressive disorder. Even though they are wired similarly and respond similarly to standard medications, they don't have its insatiable highs. Classic signs of mania include needing only a few hours of sleep at night, going on spending sprees, having insatiable sexuality, and incessant speech. This pattern is so common that we use it colloquially to describe people. When you hear someone say, "That guy's really manic," you know it means he's some combination of hyperactive and nonstop talking. If a fast-talking, fidgeting person with manic behavior bounces from high speed in one phase to darkly depressed in another, we're not surprised if they return from a psychiatrist with a diagnosis of bipolar and a script for lithium to treat it. Although I've never had any of these classically manic symptoms, I've always had more energy than most people. In high school, I was awarded the Harvard Book Prize for the top scholar athlete in my graduating class of 500. Harvard had been awarding these prizes in high schools around the country for years, but mine was the first they'd ever given to a female student. I got 800s on the SATs in math and earned A's in calculus. I went to Brown University. As an undergrad, I biked to classes, studied 4 hours straight every night, and then headed to the pool for a 1 mile swim, followed by midnight drinks with my friends. I maintained a 4.0 in science, acing physics and organic chemistry, and I started as a right wing in varsity field hockey in my freshman year. I had a blast in college, thriving on the athletic competition, the intellectual challenge, my feisty women friends, and a sense that nothing but success and accolades lay ahead. Then, out of nowhere, a door slammed on my life. On the morning of my 21st birthday, I couldn't get out of bed. I was suddenly immobilized. I was a senior in college. There was no precedent for this, and there had been no warning. My legs were too heavy to raise from under the blankets. I did not want to see friends, did not want to get dressed, and could barely get up to lug myself to class. Not one to skip class, I did drag myself there. That afternoon, my brothers and sister, all older than me, drove from Boston to surprise me on my birthday. The three of them hid under the covers of my double bed and gleefully yelled, "Surprise!" when I got back from class. Instead of delight, I felt terror and shame. I did not recognize myself in this state of flat affect combined with a sense of doom, and I didn't want Martha, Bill, and Dan to see me like this. They took me out for a celebratory dinner that night, pasta and beer at a favorite Italian restaurant in East Providence. My family is a boisterous crew. It's impossible to finish a sentence without being interrupted. were too enthusiastic about our ideas to wait for a break in the action. I barely spoke a word that night, despite generous toasts and proclamations for my bright future now that graduation was on the horizon. I'd already been accepted by an Ivy League medical school. The conversation switched from me to the Bruins, love 'em, and Ronald Reagan, hate 'em, and our parents' upcoming 35th wedding anniversary. Given the hearty competition for airtime, my sibs didn't notice my silence. They departed for the one-hour drive north to Boston close to midnight. I felt both relieved and empty. Relieved that I would not have to make the physically exhausting effort of trying to appear normal. And empty, more alone than I'd ever been in my life. I sat down and sketched a stick figure of a girl at the bottom of a valley surrounded by ominous mountains, reaching up, beseeching, with no one to respond to her cries for help. That was me. For the next month, I wrestled. It was as if some force had beaten me, pulled a plug at my core, and drained my zest for life, leaving me zombie-like. My expressive face became flat, my emotions monochromatic, my ability to conjure positive futures gone. I was graduating a semester ahead of my classmates and dragged myself to the only class I needed to pass to finish college. During most of my time at Brown, I'd always sat in the first couple of rows of the lecture hall so I could focus. Now I sat as far from the professor as possible, in the cold wooden chairs of the balcony of a cavernous lecture hall, slumped over, too exhausted to sit up straight, while my religious studies professor, an ancient, crotchety, Ivy League stereotype with a tweed coat and an upper-class Yankee accent, droned on about something I could barely understand. In the end, I scraped by with a C-. After 16 years of school, it was the first time I'd ever received anything less than a B. The truth is, that passing grade was a gift I didn't deserve because I really didn't know anything about the material. In the month since my birthday, I had learned nothing. I could not focus, could not concentrate, could not recall words or concepts or facts. My typical self-discipline and ease with academics had vanished, replaced by an unfocused mind that I had no experience with and didn't understand. What had happened to my good brain? Who was this alien who had seized my life? I suddenly had more compassion for people with learning disabilities and chronic low grades, but I sure didn't want to be one of them. I wanted this nightmare of me with a dysfunctional brain to be over. Terrified, I wanted to wake up to the feisty, smart, easy self I identified with as me. Yet, hour after hour, the nightmare continued. I slogged through life torn in two from the inside. I had no love for anything, yet I missed my joie de vivre. I lost all interest in friends, yet I craved time with them. I stopped biking to class, but hungered for the exhilaration of physical activity. All I wanted to do was sleep, but rest eluded me because I felt guilty and ashamed for spending my days sleeping. I lived inside an excruciating paradox. Whatever I chose to do in any moment, I was sure I should be doing the opposite. If I were home in Boston with family, I wanted to be in Providence with friends. If I were out with friends, I wanted to be home by myself. And if I were home by myself, I felt painfully lonely. No choice was ever right. My siblings sent word to our mother after visiting me on my birthday. My mother, then 57, looked 15 years younger. Like her own mother, she had gone to Wellesley College, class of 1947. She carried the demeanor of a well-bred Yankee, elegantly dressed, well-spoken, quick-witted, and politically astute. She wrote crisp letters to the editor whenever she found their prose or positions to be below her standards. With all her good looks, charm, and intelligence, my mother didn't have much use for feelings. In her world, stoicism was of greater value than feelings. You didn't air your dirty laundry and didn't talk about emotions. I am 6 years old, living in a dark, musty Cape Cod cottage. There are weathered gray shingles and a handful of dusty Munton windows that don't let in the sun. There's green mold growing on the windowsills. My brown hair is in pigtails that haven't been combed in days. I'm wearing a red t-shirt and a pair of my brother Dan's cut-off blue jeans that I keep up with a thin nylon rope tied around my waist. "Mom, I'm hungry," You'll have to get yourself something to eat. My mother's voice is tired, almost lifeless. I use both hands, lean back, and open the fridge, but I don't see much. There is a bottle of Coke. One cool thing about this house is that it has a bottle opener right on the cabinet, and I can reach it. I open the Coke and take a swig. It is sweet and cold. Can we go to South Beach today? No answer. I go to the door of her room to see what's going on. My mother's glued to the bed. My father's working in Boston all week. I have no idea where my brothers and sister are, just gone. I'm alone with this empty shell of a mother. The lively, pretty, brown-eyed mom who liked to take me shopping for clothes and read me books has disappeared. I don't know why or when she'll be back. Every day, reaching for sunlight, I escape on my blue banana boat bike and head for the beach alone. My mom never asks where I'm going. My family is building a house on the beach about a mile away. I'm pretty fast on my bike, so it takes me only 10 minutes to get there. I can smell the salt air as I get closer. I like to sit on a rock near the gray foundation and watch the men work. They have big muscles and are dark tan, probably from working outside all day. They are pouring concrete to make a cellar. There is a fresh, warm breeze blowing off the ocean. I feel safe here in the light of the sun and sound of the waves. I guess I don't bother the workmen, and they let me hang out there. I stay for most of the day. As it begins to get colder, I realize I should head home. I'm a little hungry, too. The ride home is easier because it's downhill, so I get there fast. My heart hopes that my mom will be up to greet me with her warm smile and a glass of milk, but my mom is still in bed. She never asks where I've been. I guess I'll have to find something to eat. There is bread in the green tin bread box and some peanut butter on the shelf. I find a knife and spread it. It's a little hard to spread the peanut butter. It makes some holes in the bread. It's okay. It still tastes good. There's not much to do. Luckily, I have a record of Mary Poppins, the first movie I had ever seen in a movie theater. We'd watched it last summer when it came out. I love that record, and I know how to lift the needle up on the little record player and start it. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious. If you say it loud enough, you'll always sound... I don't remember how to say the next word. My mom looks like Mary Poppins when she's happy. I like to look at the record cover. Later that evening, I'm lying in my single bed under the covers. My mom comes to my bedside and sits on the edge. Sarah, I know this might be hard for you to hear, but I'm leaving your father. I'm sad and scared by the news at first, but I didn't know then that she'd tell me this story many times over the next weeks and months. She never leaves. I stop believing her. It is 1974, and I'm a 13-year-old high school freshman. I've watched my mom wrestling with depression all through my growing up years. When I graduated from elementary school, she decided to go back to school to get her master's degree in social work. I guess the workload was too demanding, but I didn't really pay too much attention because I was busy with my friends, sports, and school. She finds it hard to concentrate on the homework, can't focus or finish chapters. I don't understand this. It's easy for me to get my homework done. She stops going to class. I know she's in trouble one afternoon when I come home from school early because field hockey is rained out. She's in bed. The room is pitch black and the curtains are drawn. I see the pills by her bed encased in a cardboard wrapper. I never understand why they put that scary picture on the cover, the one that looks like a mad woman literally pulling her hair out. How can that make a depressed person feel better? I suspect it's a way for the drug company to make her feel bad, so she'll need more of that drug. We don't cry or show fear in my household, but we're somehow allowed to get mad. I'm mad that my mom is absent from my life. I'm mad that she seems to have no control over this thing. I'm mad that she loses energy and focus and turns cold. I don't raise my voice or rage like my dad, but I'm snide and disrespectful, and I know, mean. I can't seem to help myself. I have to blame someone. The muscles in my neck get tight, and I spew it out. Why don't you just get up and deal with your life, Mom? Jesus, you've been telling me you're leaving Dad for a decade, yet you just sit here and take his abuse. No wonder you're depressed. Finish school. Get a job. Do something. She doesn't answer, just turns away. She is weak and lazy, and I can't stand to be around her. I feel her mood sucking the air out of the room, and it's almost as if I have to get outside to breathe. I dial my best friend, Martha. Can you meet me at Elliott Park? Sure. With that, I am gone. My mother had suffered from depression on and off since I was a baby. I remember each occurrence vividly, starting from the time I was 6 on Cape Cod. She had been on lithium since I was a young teen. When I was 21, still seeking my place in the world separate from my parents, she was the woman in the family with mental illness. I defined myself as her opposite. I was the competitive athlete, the liberated woman, the mountain-scaling adventurer. Above all, I was upbeat and never constitutionally negative, as I'd seen her at her worst. Her father had also been a victim of debilitating depressions. This was in the 1940s and 1950s, when no one talked about such things. My mother's mother had always been upbeat, cheerful, positive, and bright, never hinting at what it might have been like to live with a man who was president of his company and a pillar in the community, but so sick with depression that he underwent electric shock treatment. My grandmother maintained her dignity and grace throughout all that. From her parents, my mother learned the Yankee way, show no emotion. I referred to her as a Yankee Jew, the oxymoron intentional. She was Jewish by identity and heritage, but Yankee by training and practice. Her mother's side of the family had been in Boston since the late 1800s, long before most European Jews immigrated to the U.S. Her mother had graduated from Wellesley College in 1919. Her father had gone to Harvard. At their home, people did not raise their voices nor express emotion. Sharp intellect, witty remarks, and steady composure were valued. After graduation, she'd met my father, also Jewish, in New York City, and they'd married the following year. She became an archetypical post-World War II suburban housewife, mother of 4 baby boomer kids, with a Navy vet husband who worked 60-hour weeks at the electronic parts distribution company he started. As a man of his generation, my father knew only one way to manage his stress. Hit the gin. Like her parents, my mother presented a front of composure and stability, even when her depressions were so debilitating she couldn't get out of bed. My father had no way of supporting her emotionally. She displayed a Kennedy-esque image of our family of 6, good-looking, smart, talented, and a model for the community. We were the picture-perfect postcard of enviable health and promise. She never let anyone know she was depressed. She never told any of her friends about her condition. She never revealed it to her own parents and siblings. She had no therapists, no women's circles, no models for sharing emotional depth. So she soldiered on, as she would say, ever the proud stoic. This standard made her appear brittle and unapproachable to me, especially on matters of the heart. In retrospect, understanding more about her personal history with mental illness, I imagine she must have been distraught when she heard about my struggle with depression. She feared the worst, that she had passed on to me the gene that had taken her and her father down. She made the trip to Providence and took me out to lunch for a rare one-on-one conversation. I made sure we went to a restaurant far from campus where none of my friends would see us. She asked about my mental state. How are you feeling? I don't know. Are you depressed? Well, I can't get out of bed. What would you call it? I could hear the sarcasm in my voice, a chronic, as yet unexamined anger toward my mom seethed below the surface. It came out in curt, passive-aggressive answers to her questions. I was mad for many reasons I'd not yet worked through. Her absence from my life due to her depressions, her inability to stop my dad's drinking and rage alcoholism, her lack of emotional availability, her focus on appearance and elegance over emotional honesty, and her tendency toward quick judgment and dismissal of people she deemed below her social and academic class. But in this moment, I saw the pain in her eyes as she ignored the sarcasm and pronounced with sadness and resignation, "I'm afraid you've got the family disease. You know, your grandfather had it too." I felt tension in my neck and heat rising in my throat. "Just because you're chronically depressed doesn't mean I'm going to be. I'm nothing like you, Mom. You've always acquiesced to those arrogant Harvard doctors and their damn smug diagnoses, but that's not me. I wanted no part of that diagnosis. I would not surrender to it. I would fight it with every ounce of my being. I would not share my mother's fate. Hadn't I done everything? Sports, math, science, adventure, persistence, discipline, to follow the positive parts of my dad's trajectory? This was 1982, and with the dogmatic clarity of a 21-year-old empowered by feminist theory, I believe my mother had been had by the male-dominated medical profession and profit-driven pharmaceutical industry. I judged that she'd not done enough of her own work to cure herself of the disease. She should have been in therapy, confronted her raging husband, exercised more, eaten right. If she'd done all these things, I reasoned, she wouldn't need lithium or any other drugs. They were a crutch, and I wanted no part of them. The family disease was a myth of convenience for my mother's laziness. I was stronger than that. I would find my own way to a cure. And so began my valiant, passionate, persistent beyond reason pursuit to conquer my depression. If it was Everest, I would climb it. If it was the moon, I would reach it. If it was fascism, I would defeat it. I would do anything to prove that I alone was in control of my life. It would take me 25 years to discover the futility of this quest.